KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Stockton, California.
I live next door to Bob Saget.
Selma.
Rockridge.
Tracy, California.
Noe Valley.
Coming up, we'll talk about a new perspective on dinner time conversation.
I was really astonished by how eager people were to come and talk about death.
How death cafes are attracting thousands of people. Then we'll hear about the longest-running queer theater in the world.
We're still playing to the gay men who find sexuality both exciting and amusing.
And we'll head high on a hill in San Francisco, where a monument devoted to all that is good once stood.
All of the landscape that this statue was supposed to sort of urge to liberty and philanthropy. That's all still here.
That's coming up on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Death is an uncomfortable subject for many people. The way we die is one of the most important conversations Americans are not having. But during the last 5 years, a movement to break the silence has been growing. Thousands of people around the world are now attending death cafes and death over dinner events. That's group conversations about death, often with total strangers. As part of her End of Life series, KLW's Joanne Marr has this report.
We have name tags?
Yeah, so you're at this table.
It's a fall day in Berkeley, and 14 people are gathered to talk about death and personal loss over glasses of fine wine and a delicious meal.
That's a lentil salad.
This is butternut squash and spinach lasagna.
They're here at the invitation of the Jewish Community Center East Bay, which is hosting its first Death Over Dinner.
I think about my father, who died at the age of 96.
And I never went to visit her. I didn't go to her funeral. This is just sort of the way my family treats death.
Right to the end, she really was embracing her life as it was. I will totally miss her forever.
One of the greatest losses now is that I can't thank her.
The Jewish Community Center's Amy Tobin was co-host at one of the dinner tables.
So each person spoke about the person who had been meaningful to them, who they had lost, and then they silently lit a candle and left it on the table, and then each of those candles burned. What I do like about it is that it gave each person a quiet moment of reflection. It brought the person's spirit into the room who they were talking about. And it gave a nice space before the next person talked. So from that perspective, and that's what ritual usually does, it was a very elegant thing to do.
The first Death Over Dinner took place in San Francisco 5 years ago. Since then, over 100,000 Death Over Dinners have been held in 30 countries.
Hi, are you here for the Death Cafe?
Yeah.
Hi, welcome. What's your name?
Helen.
Helen, I'm Jim.
Jim, nice to
Glad
meet
to
you.
Glad to see you.
Death cafes are similar to Death Over Dinner, but less formal. Jim Van Buskirk is at the door, greeting new arrivals to the Death Cafe he helped start 2 years ago in San Francisco. 25 people have come, most of them strangers to each other. They're sitting in a circle, sipping tea and eating cookies and fruit.
So I guess we're going to go ahead and get started. And who hasn't been to a Death Cafe before? Oh, good.
Wow.
So about half of you. That's great. So take a deep breath. It's fine. It's not scary. It's actually fun.
Van Buskirk and two co-facilitators explained the guidelines at the start of the two-hour meeting. The forum is open to any discussion related to death.
It's like a Quaker meeting. Whoever wants to dive in and say, my cat died 2 years ago and I can't stop thinking about it. Or I'm trying to deal with the clutter left by my recently deceased parent. So it's all over the map.
The stories can be serious and funny in turns. The conversations are freewheeling and can become deeply philosophical. What is death? Is there an afterlife? What about reincarnation? Above all, death cafes are an outlet for people to speak about unmentionable subjects. It's a safe space for people to talk freely in confidence. Their last names are not revealed to protect their identities. Glenn was attending his first death cafe, and he asked the group, "Where were you 30 years ago when I needed you?" He says he experienced many deaths in his family at a young age, and he had no one to talk to. As a young man, Glenn was confused, angry, and full of emotional pain.
It's cathartic to get things off your chest. I think hearing other people's stories would put things into perspective. You know, maybe it's not something that you need to be angry about. It might have made death seem a little bit more almost just natural, especially as you see people approaching it with such humility. It doesn't necessarily have to be, I don't know, such a shocking, you know, upheaval.
By hosting these events, Van Buskirk and his colleagues hope that death will become demystified and less scary.
Our logo was going to be, talking about death won't kill you.
Because fear of death is so great, most Americans are unprepared for the end of life. Although 75% of people polled want to die in their homes, only 25% actually do.
Because people are so resistant to writing their will or working on their advanced care directive, because they're afraid that if they have all their documents in order, that it's going to invite the Grim Reaper. The more we talk about it and the more we incorporate it back into our lives, the better off we'll all be.
The growing public interest in death led to last year's Reimagine End of Life, a week-long festival in the Bay Area sponsored by the local design firm IDEO. And full disclosure, the festival was sponsored by KALW2. In 2013, redesigning death became one of IDEO's priority areas. How to promote conversations about living and dying using art and design.
And we thought, could we tap into the local conversations and the local activity that's already happening around this topic?
Shoshana Berger is IDEO's editorial director.
So death over dinner, death cafes, death podcasts, all of that was already happening. So IDEO really acted as something of a convener, gathering everyone together for 1 week to have a local civic conversation about death.
The Reimagine Festival hosted panel discussions, music, poetry, storytelling, and art installations. Berger says over 2,000 people attended the event.
We were shocked by the numbers. I mean, it was sold out crowds and standing room only throughout the week. It was hard to get into these events. I was really astonished by how eager people were to come and talk about death. You know, it's not exactly a date night thing.
The last sound I wish to hear in my life would be a gentle breeze through the trees.
Or being on a mountainside and hearing the wind go past.
The ocean.
The ocean waves hitting the beach.
Berger says one of the festival highlights was this sound collage by performance artist Yoko Kay, a vivid reminder that eventually everyone dies.
It's life. It's movement.
It's transformative.
Genetically calming. I think we've slept by water.
It's like their happy place.
Jim Van Buskirk says overcoming taboos and accepting death can help us live more fully in the present.
I'm reminded about how temporary we are, how, you know, we have a very short time on this planet. And I think what the Death Cafe does is remind everybody, we may not have tomorrow. So if you're going to do something, do it today. If you want to tell somebody, I love you, or resolve a conflict, now is the time.
Public discussions and festivals centered around death would have been unimaginable 20 years ago. The hosts and organizers of death cafes and death over dinner believe they have now paved the way for thousands of open, honest conversations about the end of life. For Cross Currents, I'm Joanne Marr.
Find more stories from Joanne Marr's End of Life series at our website, kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. When it came time to choose a musical to put on this summer, the team at San Francisco's Theater Rhinoceros knew they wanted to pull out all the stops for their 40th anniversary. And that's how this queer theatrical institution decided on Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. It's a show about two drag queens and a transgender woman who hop on a bus and travel across Australia, lip-syncing to 70s diva anthems and having adventures along the way. But behind the glitter and costumes and feel-good music, there's a message of equality and inclusion that Theater Rhinoceros tries to evoke in all of its shows. Executive Director John Fisher sat down with KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs to reflect on 40 years of queer theater.
So for those of you who don't know, Theater Rhinoceros is the longest-running queer theater company in the world, right? Founded
That's
in 1977.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the company?
Well, it was founded in 1977 when there was very little queer representation. It wasn't in film. It wasn't in theater. There were very few books. And so it was a way of getting queer lives in front of the audience. And since then, it's just grown and grown. It's expanded to include lesbians and transgenders and people who are questioning. So it's really become a hallmark for all queer theater. There have been other queer theaters. They just haven't lasted as long or they're younger. So Theater Rhinoceros goes all the way back into the mid-70s. So it really is a link to the birth of the queer movement.
And so what did it mean for you when you found this queer theater space? What?
Well, I think when I was in college, I was like in the closet because it was like the Reagan era and gay was bad and you weren't supposed to be gay or, you know, you weren't supposed to be gay when you were 20. Wait till you're 40. Wait till you've had kids. You know, it was like all that stuff. So when I started doing theater in college, I was very frustrated because I wanted to tell queer stories. And then when I went back to graduate school, I was like, well, I'm just going to tell queer stories. And I did these plays and I gave them obnoxious titles like The Joy of Gay Sex because I wanted everybody to know it was like about gay people, right? I didn't want to be like Angels in America. I mean, like, what's that really about? I wanted them to know before they even came in the door. And so to then move from the university to San Francisco and actually be doing theater at a theater that only does queer theater was for me like another coming out. It was like, wow, you know, it's not just that I'm gay and I also do theater. It's like, I will do gay theater. So for me, it was like bringing all the worlds together that were important to me. The two most important things in my life are theater and queerness.
And what do you think has, why has Theater Rhinoceros lasted so long? Why has it been so successful?
I think it's turned challenges into opportunities. The first challenge it faced was AIDS, and AIDS killed 4/5 of the people who founded the theater. It almost destroyed the theater. So the people who survived turned around and created the AIDS show, which was the first theatrical representation of the AIDS pandemic ever in the United States. And it was a show that talked about living with AIDS. And no, people weren't getting that anywhere else. They weren't getting it off TV. They weren't getting it from the newspaper. There was a lot of disinformation and a lack of coverage. So the AIDS show really was an opportunity that arose from a challenge. And Theater Rhinoceros has always found opportunities and challenges. Right now, we're doing a show, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which is about transgenders. I mean, it's a musical and it's a lot of fun, but it's also about the challenges of being a transgender.
For those of you who haven't seen the movie, it's based on a movie.
Right, like, an Australian movie.
Australian movie. Tell me a little bit about what it's about.
It's about three gay guys. Two of them are, they dress up in women's clothing. They're basically female impersonators. And the third is a transgender. And they head across Australia to the middle of the country, Alice Springs, so that one of them can be together with his son. So back when he was young, he had a son with a woman. And now the woman has called him and said, you know, our kid is growing up great, but he wants a father. Their story is really uplifting. It's about how, you know, the world is accepting transgenders because transgenders are demanding acceptance. In other words, Theater Rhinoceros, everybody asks where the name comes from. Well, it's named after the rhinoceros. The rhinoceros is a big, loving, decent creature. Doesn't harm anybody. It's a vegetarian. But if you attack it, it fights back. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is the model for the queer movement. We're loving. We're peaceful. We're gay. Gay means happy. But if you attack us, we fight back. We fight for our rights.
I'm speaking with John Fisher, Artistic Director of Theater Rhinoceros in San Francisco. We saw a couple of years ago Fun Home,
right. Mm-hmm.
And Modern Family is on TV, and
that's
there
right.
are more and more different representations of gay and queer life in various kinds of media. So tell me a little bit about why it's still so important to have a theater company really dedicated to presenting queer work.
I think that's a good question, and I think our assumption is that as it becomes more and more a part of the mainstream, it's no longer necessary. We try to stay at the cutting edge of things. In other words, what you're going to see on TV or what you're going to see on Broadway is somehow a little bit safe. There are moments even in Priscilla that are very naughty. They're a little too naughty for TV or Broadway. And I'm very proud of that because I feel a titter in the audience. And I feel like, you know, we're still playing to the gay men who find sexuality both exciting and amusing. And the lesbian audience, which is titillated and excited by jokes directed at them and for them. And I don't see in television and movies quite the extremity to which we go with our work. And I don't see quite as much transgender representation as we're committed to, or the lives of underrepresented communities within the queer community. We did a show at the beginning of the year about three African-American men with queer themes, and there just isn't that much out there about that now. As a matter of fact, the show was written by the same guy who won the Academy Award for Moonlight.
Barry Jenkins?
I mean, why aren't there more queer African-American writers out there whose work is getting done? And so I don't always feel that the representation is either enough or playing to quite the cutting edge that we work towards. I mean, I really feel like what we're doing now is what's going to be done in film in 10 years.
Yeah.
And we're still ahead of all that. And I feel like our audience feels that too. They still want the naughtiness. They still want the extremity. They still want the confrontation aspect of it.
And sort of thinking in the future, near and sort of like 5-10 years from now, when you say cutting edge, what do you think that you guys are going to continue working towards?
So I feel like this country, it'd be nice to say that there'll be new battles to fight, but I still feel like we're fighting the old battles. And in San Francisco, I think we feel like, you know, all the battles are won, and probably largely to some extent they are. But in the middle of the country, it's a whole different story.
Yeah.
You know, this is a story about three men who go from Sydney to the middle of Australia. And I feel like when we travel from San Francisco to the middle of our country, we encounter the same prejudices.
That was John Fisher, executive director of Theater Rhinoceros, speaking with KELW's Nina Gensler-Debs. John is directing the current run of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which is showing at the Eureka Theater through July 1st. The cast will also be cruising in a bus in the Pride Parade this weekend. For more details, go to KALW.org and click Crosscurrents.
We will make a plan together. We will fly so high together. Tell our friends goodbye together. We will start life new together. This is what we'll do. Go away.
This is Crosscurrents. I'm Hannah Baba. Theater is ephemeral. Statues are permanent. At least they're supposed to be. But in San Francisco, one that once looked out over the entire city is no longer in place. Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible has more.
Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert.
In Ozymandias,
the poem by Percy Shelley,
the poem is about a historic monument of a figure.
A shattered visage lies.
Who has a wrinkled lip and a sneer of cold command. The statue points to all the works around him, and the poem reads, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings.
King of Kings.
King of Kings.
Look upon my works,
ye mighty,
and despair.
And despair." And the rest of the poem says that all of the works that the statue is pointing to have disappeared.
Nothing beside remains.
So it's really a poem about that the figure remains, but everything around it has disappeared. Everything that the figure and the statue was supposed to be proud of.
But this is about another former statue that once stood high above San Francisco.
This is kind of the inverse. All of the things around it, all of the landscape that this statue was supposed to sort of urge to liberty and philanthropy, that's all still here. The San Francisco, the statue was dedicated to improving, is there, but the statue itself has disappeared.
That's William Littman.
I teach architectural history at the California College of Art in Oakland and San Francisco.
And we're walking up to what I think may be the greatest place in all of San Francisco that few people have ever heard of, on what was once considered the geographic center of the city.
So here we come up. It's this kind of raised plinth
on top of Mount Olympus.
A massive stone pedestal that rises up to nothing.
It's the base of a statue that isn't there.
Where once this 12-foot-high bronze statue stood on top of it.
On a site that has some of the best views of the entire city.
And the view is insane. It's a 360 view of the city.
The statue was called the Triumph of Light.
It was a statue of this woman who looked a little like the Statue of Liberty. She was holding aloft a giant torch. In the other hand, she had a piece of parchment. And below her was a crouched figure kind of reaching up to these two objects as if it was symbolizing mankind reaching for light and liberty.
It was erected in 1887 by then-developer and future mayor Adolf Sutro as a symbol of liberty and progressivism.
When Sutro dedicated the statue in 1887 on Thanksgiving Day, he told the crowd, "May the light shine from the torch of the goddess of liberty to inspire our citizens to good and noble deeds for the benefit of mankind."
It was supposed to stand forever, to be a timeless reminder
about the importance of liberty and civilization and philanthropy.
But it didn't last.
In the 1930s, people were referring to it as the Mystery Monument. So obviously people have forgotten about Sutro and his goals. And then by the 40s, there's discussion about removing it.
After decades of neglect, sometime in the 1950s,
it just disappears. And people discuss it online where it may have gone, so no one knows. People really do come up to this hill. The same things that drew Sutro here bring dog walkers and, you know, just urban walkers to come up here. Maybe through these kind of discussions, we can actually have someone maybe decide to build a new statue. I mean, who knows what it would look like, though? Imagine the debates about how would you symbolize liberty and philanthropy.
Yeah, I don't know if I would like to see anything else here. Does that make me weird?
Okay. I know. I mean, that is... Then what we should have here is a little plaque telling people that there was once this beautiful sculpture to light and liberty and philanthropy, and now it's gone. So that's what we need to work on. Although a sense of mystery is always good. You know, people look up and think, what could have been up there? What is missing?
99% Invisible is about the stories of human-made objects, and maybe in this case, the absence of the object makes for a better story. A monument to learning and light and liberty that's missing is almost a more amazing monument that says more about us.
About just neglect and how a city forgets its past.
That's Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible, whose radio home is right here at KALW. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn more about the Triumph of Light at KALW.org. And that's all for us today. Our team includes Andy Bosselman, Chris Hoff, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Sonia Hudson, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Ju, Lisa Morehouse, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, Andrew Stelzer, and Laura Wenis. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Okay. It's monkey time again. Children, you know you love to jump. So, here we go. Five monkeys.
This music is by kids calypso artist Ashiba from Oakland. He'll be playing Caribbean sounds in a family concert at the Temescal Farmers Market in Oakland this Sunday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Monkeys jumping on the bed. That is what the doctor said. Well, four monkeys were playing on the bed.